This Week in Radio Tech, episode 285, is brought to you by the Telos Alliance, wishing you a Merry Christmas. Watch Santa's visit to Telos coming up in the show. By the ZipStream lineup of audio processors and stream encoders. Stream like you mean it, with ZipStream software or hardware. And by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. If it sounds sketchy, distorted, or muffled, they won't listen. Podcasting guru Mike Phillips divulges his secrets for capturing clean, clear audio. Mics, preamps, consoles, what he recommends, and how to use them. This is a must-watch for podcasters and any audio content creators. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Glad you're here. It's episode 285 of our fine podcast. We've been doing this for a while, and today it's going to be a great show because we're going to head back to basics and learn about some analog audio technology. We're going to get some picks of, you know, favorite microphones, audio mixing consoles, things to make podcast, things to do production right in your mama's basement. Oh, okay, in your home, wherever you are. How are you going to make the best sounding audio from your place, from your small studio to do podcasts or whatever? So I'm delighted to have our guest on the show. We'll get to him in just a minute. Let's bring in our usual co-host from an undisclosed location somewhere in the New York City greater metropolitan area. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Well, hello, Kirk. How are you doing?
Terrific. I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Just troubleshooting a barracks situation. But other than that, things are going very well.
Hey, if you need to get up and troubleshoot, you know, the competitor, that's fine. Just let me know.
Yeah. Okay, fine. I'll be right back.
Okay. All right. Chris, seriously, are you leaving for a minute?
Yeah, just give me a minute.
Okay, sure. Take your time. All right. So our show has Chris Tobin. He usually gives us a weather report. I'm sure he'll be back to give us one in a moment. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance, and I appreciate them being one of the sponsors on this show. So this is the show, This Week in Radio Tech, where we talk about everything audio, and sometimes we talk about RF technology, all the stuff that has to do with radio. And now radio more and more is getting content from, say, other places outside the radio station. Hey, at my radio stations, we have news, local news, done by a guy who's a little out of the market. He's got stringers in the market, but he reports the news from out of the market and FTPs, or actually drop boxes, that those newscasts to us. Extremely reliable. He sounds great. And my point is that more content is coming in from all over the place. And so we're going to talk about content creation and what are some of the simple things you can do to have great sounding content creation in, you know, out of the way places, not a real, what we think of as a real professional broadcast control room or production room. And to help us with that, we're going to bring back on the show a guy we've had on before. It's Mike Phillips. I call him the guru of audio podcasting. Hey, Mike, how are you? Glad you're here.
I'm doing well, Kirk, and thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I'm always impressed with, you know, your mic situation. You've got a lot of opinions on microphones, and I enjoy hearing them. What is that contraption you have in front of you right now?
What do you mean contraption? What do you mean? Come on, Kirk.
That looks like a big boy's microphone right there.
Well, see, this is why we need Chris. Chris knows exactly what it is. Let me see if I can help.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Sorry.
Let me mute it. Does that help?
You can poke somebody's eye out with that thing.
I understand. Sometimes you have to. This is a Sennheiser MKH 416.
Well, I've heard about that microphone. Isn't that the one that all the big boy voiceover guys in Hollywood and places? News reporters use it? All right.
Yeah, I just fixed one for a guy the other day.
There you go.
Is this mic about $1,000?
It is exactly $1,000, unless the price has changed since I looked last.
All right. I see guys like Joe Cipriano using this thing, and Mike Phillips. It must be good. Why? You know what? Tell you what. Let's keep the audience hanging on. We got to do our first commercial of the show. But I want to know why I should spend $1,000. And I've been tempted to. Why should I spend $1,000 on that microphone? And if I do, what accessories do I really, really need to go along with it? Because I've noticed they sell the mic by itself or with an accessory kit. So we're going to get to that. Mike Phillips is going to be with us, and Chris Tobin will be with us. But first of all, I want you to sit through this. This is fantastic. Our sponsor, the Telos Alliance, has done this video with a visit from Santa, and it is just amazing. You're going to want to watch it. You're going to want to find it on YouTube later on and spread it to your friends. So let's hear from the Telos Alliance.
Ho, ho, ho! Merry Christmas, everybody! Santa's here today to get some nice goodies for all our good engineers and maybe some for our naughty ones. So let's get into it and see what I have in my goodie bag here. Oh, a Telos VSET 6. This is going to be for a special engineer. I just know it. Nanny could call the North Pole and tell me what else he would like. Oh, what else do I have in here? Oh, it looks like an X-Node. Yes. Oh, it's beautiful. X-Node right there for another great special engineer. Probably been very good. Oh, let's see what else I have in the bag. Oh, it's one of our newer products, the Omnia 7. What a wonderful product. Great online tools inside for making your audio sound wonderful on the plant. Oh, let's see what else I've got in the bag. It's another Telos VSET 12. Beautiful piece here. Pick up the phone, make a phone call to Santa. Oh, that's wonderful. Some lucky engineer is going to get that one. What else have I got in my bag? Oh, ZipStream. Yes, beautiful ZipStream. You can send your audio via codec. It's wonderful. Great present for a nice, lucky engineer. Oh, my goodness. This is a very huge, large piece of audio processing gear, the Omnia 11, the flagship of Telos Omnia Axio. It's wonderful. Make your audio processing just scream off the dial. And make your audio for Christmas songs sound great. My ho-ho-ho's nice and deep. Yes, this will be a great present for a wonderful engineer. Oh, it's the 25.7 TDM, the program delay. This is for your profanity. Yeah, push that button and all those naughty words go away. Some lucky engineer is going to save their station a lot of money on the fines they could impose on them. See, oh, it's a linear acoustic LQ-1000. Oh, for those TV engineers that have been really good, this is going to make that audio sound wonderful. Yes, I know that there is a Santa Claus, Virginia, and it's going to sound great with this product. Oh, it's a Telos HX2. A dual hybrid. One hybrid for Santa, and one hybrid for the mistress, Mrs. Santa Claus. Yes, your audio on the telephones will sound wonderful. Oh, it's an Omnia 1. Oh, I've given about 12,000 of these out so far. A wonderful engineer is going to get this wonderful unit, and they're going to be very happy with the sound of their station. Oh, let's see what else I've got in here. Oh, how did this get in here? Oh, this is going to go to one of my engineers on my naughty list. He's going to be very disappointed. Well, that was so many gifts. Let's see if there's still something left in the bag here. Oh, my goodness gracious. This huge, beautiful Fusion console. Some special engineer is going to get this thing. Oh, I'm going to make this station very happy. Oh, that seems to be all that's in my bag here. Lots of wonderful presents here for all those wonderful, good engineers. Yes, and from all the people from Telos Alliance, we wish you a happy new year and a merry Christmas. Cookies for Santa. Oh, that's a... I see there's some other holiday spirit for me. This must be for Santa. Definitely warms the soul for my trips. Oh, I'll take that with me. Merry Christmas!
All right. I don't know what to say. Thanks very much to the Telos Alliance for sponsoring, being one of the sponsors on This Week in Radio Tech. I really appreciate that. And nice and Merry Christmas. Part. Yeah. you saw that, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's all I'm going to say. So anybody who wants to know what the milk carton's about, you're going to have to watch it.
Have to rewind. Okay. All right. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, episode 285. Chris Tobin is back with us. Chris, quick report from the New York area. What's up?
Rain is everywhere.
Is it really?
It's pouring. It's flooding. It's like flash floods. The mass transit's all upset. It's just amazing. It's just out of control. I guess it's to be expected. Since there's no snow on the ground, it's just rain and warm weather. I think this weekend's going to be a little chilly, but that's about it.
Yeah, we had that rain a couple days ago here in Nashville, and it's so you're getting it now. All right, Mike Phillips, where are you? You're in the beautiful mountains of North Carolina, aren't you?
Not at all. I am in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Oh, Raleigh, not the mountains. Okay,
not the mountains.
How's your weather?
It is horrible today. When I drove into the office, I'm on vacation, but I drove into the office. I had to do detours twice to get around accidents. My wife texted me to ask me what the weather was like. I said it was horrible, and then my son called me to tell me he had just gotten rear-ended.
Oh, no.
Yep.
So, well, let's try to find something good to talk about then.
Absolutely. Well, let's see. I've got a buddy who's in the body shop business. He's really happy today.
Okay. Yeah, I guess he would be. So back to the microphone. We teased that. I've been wondering, should I lay out $1,000 for a microphone? Because I do a fair amount of audio work. I've done 4 audio books on Amazon so far, and I've got more to do. Should I get a mic different from the one I've got for audio work, mic work?
Well, it depends. And the answer that I give to anyone who asks a question like that is you have to try the microphone on your voice. Now, do you need to spend $1,000 on an MKH-416? No, not to be in broadcasting, not to be in voiceover, not to be in podcasting. Absolutely not. But I will tell you that I bought this mic based after some research. I've had it a number of years. And I bought it because I was actually engineering some sessions for a good friend of mine. He's passed away now, but I mean, this guy had a Charlie Van Dyke type voice. And the first time that we used the mic on him in the studio, in my bedroom, at home, and when I hit the playback, the guy started crying. He had never heard his voice the way he heard it with this microphone. It doesn't sound that much different with my voice because I don't have the voice to take advantage of the proximity effect and the particular sound this mic has. But what I would say to you is get your hands on one, try it, listen critically, and then decide whether it's worth the money.
So this is the Sennheiser, you said MK416?
MKH416.
MKH.
However, there is an alternative to it that you may like as well or better that's cheaper, and that's the Rode NTG3. R-O-D-E, Rode NTG3. It's just a matter of preferences. You may like it better, you may not.
Wow. So before we went to break, I told you I had looked at buying one of these before for my own voice work, and I noticed that it comes either with or without some accessories, like the windscreen that you've got or a second windscreen or a shock mount. What's important if you're going to spend $1,000 for a mic? Do you need to spend another $100 or $200 on accessories?
Probably so. I mean, I'm going to pull this over and make a lot of ugly noise to show you, but this is actually an Audio Technica shock mount. It's one that I like. The diameter of the microphone is a standard small diameter. It's a condenser microphone. It's a standard case. And this shock mount, I forget exactly the number from Audio Technica, but it's in their catalog, is one of the best I've seen. It holds it really well. Very happy with its performance. I do recommend that because when I hit the desk, you can hear me hitting the desk, but you're not hearing.
Yeah, you're hearing it through
real
the air,
low frequency, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I do recommend that. Now, as far as the windscreen is concerned, I'm not going to take it off again. I don't know how badly I would pop the mic if I took it off because I do like to work it pretty close. I'm in a room with bad acoustics. I want to minimize the as much room echo as I can. I work it closely. The windscreen helps with that. I don't recall whether it came with it. I just don't recall. But the fact is that since I have it, I put it on there. It doesn't hurt anything.
Yeah. I've always thought of shotgun mics, obviously, as being the kind that they used to use on the Johnny Carson show. And when they're shooting movies, somebody with a mic boom has it just out of camera range, and they're pointing it at the person who's talking. And they can usually turn it quickly to whomever is speaking. And so I was so surprised years ago when I heard that voiceover artists use that MKH-416 microphone from Sennheiser for close talking their voiceovers. What do you think is the reason for it? And you alluded to it earlier. One reason would be getting rid of other room noises because it's highly directional.
I mean, the fact is that it's a multi-purpose microphone. It's probably the design spec was for a boom long-distance type microphone. But my theory is what happened is because, from what I understand, where the microphone really grabbed a lot of popularity was with Ernie Anderson, the Love Boat guy.
Oh, yeah.
A love boat. And my theory is that he had to do some sort of a crawl or had to do something and was in the TV studio. And they said, well, grab that mic over there. And they grabbed it. He recorded it and played it back. And he said, wow. And all of a sudden it became the go-to mic. That's my theory. I've never read that anywhere. And he's passed away, so we'll never know. But that's what I'm thinking anyway.
I can always think of him as not only the love boat, but tonight on Starsky and Hutch. And
he was amazing.
Tonight on Auto Man. Chris Tobin, you work in a big market, lots of high paid talent. They get whatever the mic they want. You seeing these Sennheiser mics around?
Well, in a world where we think like this. No, sorry. just another reference. Yes, actually, I oh man. Voiceover. That's a talent and a craft. I tell you, that's God bless people that can do it. There are a lot of folks here in town that use the 416. There are folks that use the Neumann U87 microphones. As Mike pointed out, it's personal preference. A friend of mine who does voice work and goes to several different ad agencies and work in different booths, he will tell me that there are times that the client will ask for a certain sound and the production facility he's at will go through a box of microphones, if you will, or cabinet, and select one that sounds the way the client thinks it should. He will sit there and just wait and go, okay, how about this? Read the script, do his thing, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, nah, now what about this one? And once in a while, he did one recording was with an SM58 microphone, vocal mic.
Yeah, he liked that the best. Huh?
Well, the client did. He didn't care. But the one thing he did discover, and he realized it afterwards, the sound booth he's in, the voice booth, was so dead that he's figuring that the different sound of the microphone or the nuances that each microphone has is what the client was hearing, the differences between, and nothing else was causing like a interference or artificial adding to it. Like Mike pointed out, in his room, his acoustics may not be ideal, so he uses a close-up talking on the microphone, blah, blah, blah. That's what he figures, because he hasn't done it in a while, but every time he's had those particular requests with a special microphone, well, not that special, the room he was doing the reading in was dead. I mean, he was so dead that he felt uncomfortable. So it's either it was a floating studio booth or it was just really, really dead. And is it, you know, your ears, your inner ear and your equilibrium is lost because you're not hearing anything.
So, Chris, you said you had to fix one of these recently. What kind of thing might go wrong with a mic like that?
Oh, the battery compartment, the little spring for the battery, for the negative element. When the person pulled the battery out, he ripped out the spring with it. It's seen better days, but it's been used a lot. But he's now been using Phantom Power for the last couple of months, so he didn't panic over the connector being broken, but he realized he probably should get it fixed, so just in case one day he's plugged into a device that doesn't provide Phantom.
So if your console or your preamp doesn't supply Phantom Power, I take it this is a condenser microphone with all that baffling or direction, those elements on the front. It'll run on batteries? And if so, how much of that inside of that mic is filled up with batteries?
Well, the one I was working on was just a single AA. Okay. I don't remember. I'm trying to think of some of the longer length shotguns. I had one that had two AA's in it, but that was it. I don't recall it being anything more than that.
Mike, does that one that you have in front of you, does that take batteries? If you want to?
What Chris is talking about is called the T model, MKH416T, which is for remote battery operated. This one is 48 volts only.
Ah, okay. Okay. Interesting. I had one more question about. Oh yeah. Okay. So you've got this $1,000 microphone and I'm Mike, it sounds great on you and I've always wanted to try one. Let's say that you're a podcaster or a content creator of some kind watching to listening to this podcast and you're thinking, you know, I'd like to get what a lot of the big time VO guys have and see how it sounds for me. What is the next critical thing in the audio chain after this microphone? Now the answer is a preamp, but do you have to have, you know, a really expensive preamp to get the benefit of this mic, or can you use something a little bit more pedestrian? I've got a Focusrite Scarlett 2i2 here, which I like fine. What kind of money do you have to spend on a preamp for a mic like this?
Well, Mike? As some people may know in the recording industry, you can spend thousands of dollars for a mic preamp. I mean, the Manly preamps, $3,500. I can think of the Great River preamps, $2,000, all sorts of very esoteric type pieces of equipment. And a lot of people will argue with me, and that's fine. I'm used to it. But I will tell you that you do not have to spend a lot of money on a preamp. The preamp I'm using right now is built into my Presonus 16.4.2 Studio Live mixer, which is a recording quality mixer. Now, if there are some really cheap preamps out there that do not do a good job. For example, don't mean to step on any toes, but the Blue Icicle, for example, is an XLR to USB preamp converter. There's also the Shure X2U. I find them to be noisy. They don't sound that great, but they're useful for what they're used for. But if you go out and spend $1,500 on a Millennium Media TD1 preamp or whatever the current model is, when you plug it in, you're going to say, you know what, I don't hear any difference. And that's probably true.
Chris, in your experience, a lot of money on the mic preamp, or can you find something that's a couple hundred bucks?
You can find a couple hundred bucks. I always, I actually have here at this facility 1, 2, 3 different types of preamps. They average about $1,500 or more. One or two of the ones that Mike mentioned. I have noticed on musical recordings, some stuff that we've done, some of the lower end price preamps could be a little coloring. But if you're doing voice work, and I helped a friend of mine build a studio, and we went through preamps like crazy and compressors and you name it, you could go low end and still do fine because you're not screaming into the microphone. You're not pushing it to its limits. I mean, if you do musical recordings, you might want to be careful because some preamps may not have a good front end, enough dynamic range, and the microphone is more than happy to deliver it, but the preamp may run into a problem. It is, as Mike pointed out, it's application. I will say, I'm not going to say spend $3,000, you got the best thing since sliced bread, because there's a good chance you got you just got a lot of hype. You do have to listen, you do have to apply it. I mean, you use a microphone for different environments, different recordings, different sources, and you match it up. And that particular microphone's got nice output, it's solid. I forget what the exact voltages are, but I guess it's considered a high output. I never really checked it out. So if you really yell into it, I'm sure the preamp could take a beating, but
I would think that my limited experience in preamps, and usually as a broadcast engineer, I'm using mic preamps that are built into audio consoles or built into a separate mic processor. So the thing that I typically look for is a low noise floor and a high dynamic range. A mic preamp has a little bit of a tough job. It's got to amplify a pretty small signal from a microphone, and it's got to amplify that, well, first of all, accurately. It's got to have a wide range, so if somebody yells in the microphone, my favorite loud phrase, he shoots, he scores, because you can get loud on that. And yet at the same time, if you're quiet, you want the room noise to be louder than the self-noise of the mic preamp. Right, so it needs to have a low noise floor. Now, if you go and buy, you can buy mic pre's on eBay for $39, and they have all kinds of things. I've tried a couple of these. A cable with a built-in mic pre and USB converter. So you've got a cable that at one end has a female XLR connector, and the other end has a USB connector. And the idea is, hey, plug this in your computer, plug the mic in, and you've got a mic pre and converter built into one. And, for $39, you just can't get the chipsets and the electronics that are going to make that work well. I've tried a couple of them, and they were not pretty at all. Mike, you mentioned the Shure X2U. I used one on the show for a few years. I was happy with it, except after a while, the analog volume controls began to get noisy and crummy, and so I quit using that and went to a Focusrite, which I realized, but the Focusrite that I have here is a $150 dual preamp, and it does have, I think it's got some discrete components on the front end, and it's got a reasonably nice interface to the computer, so it's okay. I've used it for audiobook recording. Earlier I said Amazon, I meant audible.com. I've done a few books, and they have a requirement for the noise floor. They'll go measure it on your recording that you submit. I have to turn off the furnace that's next to my office, and turn off two computers that are here in my office, so I get the room as quiet as possible. And I had to move a clock, a battery-operated clock, out to the hallway because it was, I never noticed it before, but boy, when you get that quiet, you hear little noises. And so I had to get quiet. And my point about all that is I got the room quiet and the noise of the preamp of this Focusrite was still not a problem. So that's using this Heil PR40 microphone. We may have pretty well killed the subject to death here or talked it to death, but a great microphone is probably worth getting if you want to, you know, do some serious recording. Although we know a great voice can, you know, can speak into a Shure SM58 and get decent results too. Mike, do you have any final thoughts on Mike and Mike preamp selection?
Yes, let me also say at some point we have to talk about it that you do not have to spend $1,000 and to get a decent microphone. It's just not necessary. And I want to correct something I told you, Kirk. I said I was going into the PreSonus mic preamp. That's not true. I'm actually using a DBX 286S mic processor. I was playing with some things, the reason I got confused, but I don't use any of the equalization, compression, any of that stuff. The only thing I use in the DBX 286 is the preamp and also the noise gate. I have the noise gate set on this one, and that helps tremendously with that noise floor that you're talking about. Now, while I don't recommend that somebody getting started spend a lot of money on microphones, I do believe the $200 DBX 286S is a worthwhile purchase. I mean, you can use that as a mic preamp, which it has in it, but you can also wire that directly into your computer sound card, and if you don't need a mixer, if all you need is good quality sound. So that's a recommendation. But as far as the money, if you're not going to spend $1,000, you will be stunned at the quality of this $54 Audio-Technica ATR2100 USB microphone. It's an XLR and USB microphone that will blow you away. It is unbelievable. I was even watching a major network internet show. The guy uses a PR40 all the time, has a great voice, and between breaks he said, "Well, I got one of these. I heard they're pretty good. Let's try it." So he says, "I don't hear much difference." They are great microphones, so that's my plug
now,
for those.
And with both XLR and USB, so it puts out analog on the XLR, right?
Correct.
Looks like is my video frozen or is it just me?
It's frozen here.
Okay. All
it's
right.
It's frozen on my return.
Okay. But I got audio. The magic of Skype. I'm going to let you guys talk about finishing that up. I want to know about, though, using the XLR analog out and the USB. Also, is there a memory card slot in the bottom of that thing, or what's the other slot that's there?
The slot is actually a volume control for the built-in headphone, or it's actually a built-in sound card is all it is.
Oh, my goodness.
But be careful, because as much as I love this microphone, the built-in sound card is terrible. Most people are unable to get enough signal out of the headphone jack to be able to use it successfully, but some people can. So it just all depends on how diligent you are, I guess, how efficient your earbuds are, and how deaf you are. But it's as an XLR microphone, I'm just so blown away with the quality of it, which, by the way, I have to do my little routine here. The ATR2100 is exactly the same microphone as the Audio-Technica AT2005. The only difference is color, has a little more robust windscreen, and the on-off switch is a little different. So that's the AT2005. In Europe, you can't get those mics inexpensively, so the Samson Q2U is probably the same microphone. I took one apart and found all the same parts. They weren't in exactly the same layout, so it may not be the same shop that builds these for each company, but this microphone sounds the same. In the studios that I've set up, the remote studios that I've set up in the last year, most of them have used this microphone primarily because I found them on sale and bought a boatload of them.
Wow. Huh. And so, you know, in broadcast, we tend to use Electivoice RE20s and RE27s. There's plenty of other high-end Audio-Technica, maybe even a Neumann now and then. Of course, a lot of people use the good old Sennheiser, the 421, and wasn't there
421.
What about the 441? Am I remembering that?
441 is the silver one, yeah.
Yeah. So in broadcast, we've used these mics that are just kind of standard for broadcast. That doesn't mean they have to be standard for broadcasting, and it certainly doesn't mean they have to be the standard for podcasting. Let's chat for just a minute, Mike.
While you're mentioning them, Kirk.
Yeah.
Take a look at this.
Ah, there you go. You got them all there.
So this is the 441, the 421, and of course the PR40. And I'm not going to get up to go get the RE20. So,
by the way, those of you with RE20s, you may have a broken one here and there. You know, the company Bosch, they're a German company, I think, now owns Electrovoice. Electrovoice, the RE20. I had to have one repaired, and they have a, you know, pay one price repair deal. They've had that for some time. It used to be Electrovoice would fix your mic for free. I think those days are gone. Now it's a couple $100. No matter what's wrong with it, they'll fix it. But I just want to report to you, I sent one in about a month ago and got it back in just a few days. They did a very good job. They were great communicators on the process. Took a credit card, of course, and got it fixed right away. So, you know, there is a way to get your RE20, your RE27 fixed if you don't want to try to figure out what's wrong with it yourself. And some of the parts are so small and the wiring and soldering is so small, I didn't want to deal with it. So I just sent my RE20 off to them. Just happy to have to report that there's a way to get that done. Hey, let's Mike, you want to move on to the next step, maybe audio console and what a podcaster might want to consider it for his home studio?
So if we're talking about the low end here, this is an interesting concept because the mixers that I usually recommend are made by Mackie and Behringer. And what's sort of bizarre about these mixers is they are not designed for broadcasting. They're designed for recording. The reason that we recommend those, first is price. I mean, they're really cheap. You can get a 24-channel mixer, was sort of 24-channel mixer, including the left and right, or a channel. It's kind of a bogus way of designating the channels.
It is, yes.
But you can get a quote-unquote 24-channel mixer for $350. And it's not a durable piece of equipment. It's not a professional broadcast mixer. It is not repairable for the most part. But at $350, if you're successful, if you need to, you can throw it away and buy another one. The reason we use these mixers is because they have auxiliary sends on them that we use to create a mix minus, typically for Skype, Blab, Google Voice, or some of these online communication services. They're also useful to, even in fact, the big studio I built recently, we use the Telos HX2, and we use an auxiliary send to send mix minus to the HX2. Works perfectly every time. So the low-end mixers, again, you get at least what you pay for and maybe a little bit more. But if someone is serious about podcasting for a business, and I'm not saying it because you're here, but they really need to look into serious broadcast equipment such as the Axia consoles, primarily because of the flexibilities with things like mix minus on every channel. The slide faders that feel good, you can grab them in a hurry and not grab the wrong one when you're not exactly looking. You actually, one of the benefits is you don't have equalization controls on every channel like you do on these mixers, because on these low-end mixers with all these equalization controls, believe it or not, one of the best things that I do to help people who are just starting out is teach them to leave all of their equalization controls at 12 o'clock. There are reasons to equalize things. But until you know how to operate your equipment, until you know what sound you're really getting, you don't need to start screwing with it.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, professional broadcast stations, there's no equalization per channel on the board, and there doesn't need to be. Most things that you're going to play are already produced, and they don't need a big old bump, you know, or a big cut somewhere, you know, especially with modern audio gear. We don't run across stuff that's at least I don't. I don't run across stuff that's horrible anymore. It used to be, back when I got started engineering at a rock station in Lexington, Kentucky, we would get tapes in from the agencies, and a lot of them were horrible. Left and right channels would literally be out of phase with each other, and or they'd be cranked up way high on the EQ, a mistake done at the ad agency or the production company, or they'd be too bassy or whatever. And yeah, we needed these EQ knobs to fix things. We had an outboard Orban multi-channel EQ that we could just notch some hum right out of it. But you know, for the most part, those days are gone. It's hard to make bad audio nowadays if you have a clue as to what you're doing. Chris, comment on what I just said. Am I right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, for the basic podcast and for doing it consistently, as Mike pointed out, you know, you're reaching to the console and you don't want to hit the wrong switch or turn on an EQ that you don't need. Keep it simple. Keep it straightforward. You could be more reliable and repeat successfully what you're trying to accomplish. But yeah, back in the day, it was not uncommon to have some equalizers somewhere in the audio path for one device, whether it's a telephone or some remote feed and whatnot. And you know, people were more, I guess, more tinkering and involved in doing the broadcast, you know, changing the audio sound and understanding why they did it and how they did it. But nowadays, some of the podcast folks I've helped over the years, if you don't understand the nuances, just keep it straightforward. If you're using a Mackie or a Behringer and you have the EQ knobs, keep them at 12 o'clock, you know, or turn off the switch if it's available. If you're looking to, maybe, you know what I suggested to somebody, I just remembered this. They had four microphones in the studio, three for guests and all that sort, and then the primary one for the host. Or the, you know, and I actually suggested to him, I said, you have 24 channels, 12 channels here. Tell you what, why don't you take the first one, make that your microphone of primary choice, and then blank out the next three. Don't use them. Just we'll put a little piece of tape across so you know not to use them, and then start the guest mics at like at 4, 5, and 6. And the reason I suggest that was because he kept turning up the wrong fader to talk because he was so preoccupied reading and looking elsewhere. Which, to Mike's point, to your point, you know, broadcast consoles are designed for a workflow that we've just grown accustomed to over the last 100 years. And that's basically you walk in. Left side is the mic for the on-air, for the jock, the announcer, reader, whatever, and then down the line it goes. Most people today have no idea what that means, why that's even done, or unless you're in Europe and you do the BBC model, then you have the open spot in the middle of the console and your microphone is the first thing on the left of that open spot. But these are the things, subtleties that people don't realize or understand and why they came to be. So I try to sort of mimic that same approach with some of the newer mixers. And, you know, if you don't have the need for the channels, then blank them out and make it easy for yourself, and you could just, you know, like, just reach down and you know exactly where you are.
Mike, I've got a question about...
Sounds crazy, but it works.
I got a question about the difference then in the Mackie, the Mackie quality of console and the Behringer, but first a point I should make is, okay, home broadcasters, home content creators, if you find the need to adjust an EQ knob on one of these inexpensive yet effective consoles, you really need to figure out why am I having to do this? Because you shouldn't have to. Yeah. If you got to turn the bass up or turn the bass down or the mid-range, there's something's not right somewhere else. Now, if you know what's not right and you're compensating for something that you know isn't right, fine. But you know, no broadcaster, at least in the U.S. and almost nowhere else, on any regular basis has to do that. And it's dangerous if they do, because a lot of mistakes are made that way. Now, Mike, a Mackie console, I tend to see them in the $600 to $1,000 to $1,400 range. And Behringer consoles, I see from $39 to $350, as you mentioned. What's the basic difference? Why would I choose a Mackie over a Behringer, for example?
If you look back at the ranges, the Mackies tend to be a little bit more expensive than the Behringers. The Behringers are very much the low end for the most part anyway, I guess. But the Mackies do go up to several thousand, as do the Behringers. For example, Behringer has a new digital X32 series that is really a high quality supposedly piece of equipment made by Midas or someone, I forget which, and they bought the company or something like that.
But
what we're focusing on is the low end. And why Mackie? The one thing that I like, kind of a touchy subject, because I was communicating with Behringer yesterday about some things I'm unhappy about, so I'm not in a good mood about Behringer at the moment, but I'm gonna be honest and share my experiences. And the reason that I choose the Behringer over the Mackie most often is because the Behringer has a built-in USB sound card. Now, what happens is they say, well, what difference does it make? Because if you're going to do a mix minus and a program feed, you have to have at least two sound cards. You have to have it on your computer. You can do two computers and it's not an issue, but you have to have two. If you're going to use one computer, you have to have two sound cards, one for the main audio feed and one for the mix minus to send back to Skype or Blab or Google Voice or whatever you're using. And it's really convenient, particularly for new people when they get the mixer, that all they have to do is plug in a USB cable. Now, I do think that the Mackie quality is higher. The Mackie company is easier to work with. It's easier to get a response from them. They seem to have more service outlets if you end up having to go that way, probably for warranty purposes. But all in all, there's not a tremendous amount of difference. And if you're not going to use the USB sound card built into the Behringer, then really it's just a matter of Ford versus Chevrolet.
Gotcha. Hey, we are on This Week in Radio Tech. That's what you're watching or listening to. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with Chris Tobin. He's an engineer in the New York City area, an expert on IP codecs, and doing cool things. And also our guest today is Mike Phillips. Mike has been on the show before, and he's an expert at helping people, content creators and podcasters, to get their studios set up. He's got great advice on microphones and audio consoles, and that's what we're talking about on this edition of This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at Telos, and lo and behold, they're sponsoring this slot of the show as well. I want to tell you about a line of products from Telos called the ZipStream line. This is software or hardware, either way. You know, people ask Telos, so what's the best way to encode my stream, software or hardware? And the answer is it's your choice. You know, if you're totally comfortable with dedicating a PC and keeping up with software updates, if you want to do that, and running Windows, Windows XP or 7 or 8 or 10, and running software on it to do your audio processing and stream encoding, if you're comfortable with that, sure, buy some software. Telos and the ZipStream name, they have software starting as low as about $450 or so for the ZipStream AXE. It's basic software to process and encode your stream. And then they have more high-end software like the ZipStream X2 or even the 9X2, which ends up being on the order of about $1,000 a stream for the X2 and $2,000 a stream for the 9X2. Sounds like a lot of money, but hey, this is your transmitter for the internet. You get an awesome audio processing and metadata capabilities, the ability to follow Triton protocols if Triton happens to be your chosen content distribution network, and plenty of other benefits too built in. So hey, from low to high, you've got choices there. But if you want to just plug in an appliance, and some people want that, hey, just give me an appliance. Sell me an appliance that I can plug in to the power, plug my audio in, and plug my internet in, do a little configuration, and bam, I'm on the internet, either directly or by choosing a CDN to distribute it for you. Well, there are a couple of choices there, too. There's the ZipStream R1. That is a one-rack unit box that takes in one audio program and can encode it two different ways. It's got audio processing built in, two encoders, and then up to four outputs plus confidence monitoring built in. If you need something more than that, let's say you run a cluster of radio stations and you want to put them all on the internet, there's a brand new product. It's called the ZipStream R2. And this will take up to 8 programs coming in from AES or from Livewire, and then encode each of them several different ways after the processing is done, and you get either 3-band processing or Omnia 9 processing built into it. And then you can send it out to as many places as you need to within the limits of your internet connection. So you want to send to several different CDNs or have geographical diversity on your CDNs, you can do that. Some of the products, actually most of the ZipStream products, also do this new adaptive bitrate streaming. We've talked about that here a lot on the show, but if you want to do Apple HLS or Microsoft Smooth Streaming, that's built in to the hardware ZipStream R2, also to the ZipStream X2 and the ZipStream 9X2. So check them all out. If you want to do streaming, man, do it right. If you use a free product that you download from some unknown source, I can't help you with what your audio processing will sound like or what your stream encoding will sound like, because there aren't any free encoders out there that you know meet the actual specs of AAC or MP3. So check these out. Yeah, they cost a little money, but this is your transmitter. This is for you know, a few people or a few hundred thousand people, however popular your stream becomes. So check it out at telosalliance.com and look for the ZipStream processing and encoding for streaming audio name. Check them out. That's what our stations use. And I'll tell you what, thousands of radio stations and other broadcasters are using these products all over the world. Thanks to ZipStream for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, we're here with Mike Phillips, our guest, the audio and podcasting guru, and Chris Tobin is along, too, to check us and keep us sane and add his professional experience to our conversation. Mike, I'm not sure where we want to move the conversation to next. We want to do a little bit of how-to. So we got microphones, mic preamps, either separate or built in the audio console. What's the next part of a studio that you typically help people with? How do you help them get on the air or get recorded or whatever it is that they're going to do?
With podcasting and internet broadcasting, there are a lot of net-related things like which CDNs to use, how to get the signal, the bandwidth issues and all that. I don't usually get involved in those. There are plenty of guys who understand all that. I usually get involved in the audio side of things. But one issue that is woefully underserved in the podcasting / internet broadcasting community, believe it or not, is program processing. And part of the reason is economic. I mean, whenever we talk about the sound, and if you listen to most podcast internet streams, they might have a 286S on the microphone or something like that, but very few of them are using good quality program processors. Again, the last one I built, we did put a multiband audio processor on the stream, and it sounds fantastic. I recommend that everyone do that. I'm not sure which one is the right one. That would be your department. But for someone who's going to, let's say, do a 24/7 stream, whether it's going to be audio, music, what have you, then you need a program processor, or you're going to have, I mean, think about running a radio station with no broadcast processor. Just think how critical your EQ settings are. Think how consistent the levels would not be because of the different operators, the different pieces of content. That's one growth area for podcasters and broadcasters, internet broadcasters, is going to be program processors. So that should be good news for you, Kirk.
I'd like to point out, and Chris, I'm sure you'll back me up or have something to add to this subject about audio processing. Why is it important? You know, for AM and FM broadcasters, processing has been a way to be competitive, not only to even out differences in how somebody was running the audio console, and that's important, but also to be competitively loud. Now, on the internet, with streaming, we don't so much have to be competitively loud. That's not much of a factor. You still may want to, you know, dial into your stream and have it, you know, just blast out your speakers, but that's not a key factor as it has been competitively in broadcasting. And of course, if you overdo it, it can certainly cause you detriment. It can cause fatigue in your listener's experience. But what you do want the processing for is to even out differences from show to show or element to element. Hey, so often, I got to tell you, years ago, I was at a radio station in Memphis, Tennessee. It was in the FM rack room, and I was talking with the engineer. We were having a great discussion. We were looking at an Aphex compeller, common piece of gear in a lot of radio stations, because it was like a great hand on the volume knob. So no matter how sloppily the disc jockey was running the audio console, the compeller would give you a nice even output, not processed sounding, but just at a nice even volume, so the processor could do a better job after that. And so we looked at the Aphex compeller, and all the LEDs were totally up in the red. And they were all the way blasted over, and it was not sounding distorted at all. It had a huge dynamic input range. And so I looked at that. I looked at the engineer. I said, "What do you think about that?" He said, "I think Tom Prestigiacomo is on the air." So he could tell which disc jockey was on by how the LEDs were behaving on the front of the Aphex compeller. And so the point is, Tom Prestigiacomo is a professional guy. He's a fixture in broadcasting in Memphis, Tennessee. And yet, you know, running the levels just right on the console were just not a priority for him. And more so with so many content creators and podcasters. And that's why you need some audio processing to level that out and do it in an intelligent way that ends up sounding good at the end. And if you just grab, you know, some free software or a processor just off the shelf that's not intentionally meant for doing this, then it's not necessarily going to help you. You don't want to be distorted, but you also don't want your signal to sound so quiet and so weak that listeners can't hear it. And you don't want, you know, element-to-element differences from one song to another, from one program to another, from one microphone to another. You want to have these evened out so that the listener doesn't have to do anything but listen. And that's what the process is about as far as holding the audio levels right. The other thing, though, that audio processing is about for streaming is that you don't streaming is a different kettle of fish transmission-wise than is AM or FM processing. For example, you can't use any clipping. You don't want to use any clipping for feeding an encoder. And so our last sponsor, ZipStream, the processors in those products are intentionally designed for streaming. So you'll get intelligent look-ahead limiting and you'll get no audio clipping. You'll get things that make the stream sound good and make the codec more efficient. And that's what you really want to do for processing. So, Chris Tobin, am I going wrong on any of that, or do you have something to add to what I've said? What's that?
Sound card.
Ah.
It's a sound card. That's what you're talking. My approach to the audio processing, for over the air, it's been really the competition is just making sure that the station can be heard above the competition of car environments, personal earphone environments like city streets, subways, and sorts of that nature. And I've taken that same thinking along for the podcast approach for streaming. Several things I always recommend or suggest is maintain decent levels, find a spot that works for you, and just stay within a certain window. Downstream, whatever processing you choose to go with, whether it's software application or a hardware device, don't set it aggressively. Just set it so that it keeps everything relatively above the noise floor of where the person you're trying to reach with the content will be listening to your product. Perfect example, yesterday did an event with a streaming network, and I was walking around with my iPhone with an earpiece, standard earphone, not one of the ones we use for broadcast stuff. And yeah. I was walking around the event while the live event took place, trying to understand and make sure that their settings and things worked right. And it was. I had enough range on the phone. I could make it really loud, make it really low. But I've heard many podcasts, both doing streaming from their home studio or on location, where sometimes, no matter how loud I made the phone, I could barely make out what they were saying intelligibly. Or the other way, they were too loud. No matter how low I made the phone, it was still, it was fatiguing. So that's the approach I usually try to suggest to folks is what's your goal? What's your target audience, we'll say? Do you expect most of your people to be on a phone, smartphone, or maybe listening at home on a internet radio device? Or maybe nowadays in their car with their phone plugged into the Bluetooth adapter on the dashboard or maybe directly wired in? And that's the approach I take. So I don't worry about the algorithm streaming, the methods, that all that stuff anymore. I more look at, is it properly streaming, properly encoded? Right. Are we doing processed audio in the proper manner for a streamed or bit-reduced environment? Right. Now, do we find a happy level? Like the big thing nowadays is what? Dial normal in television, right? The loudness concerns and the COM Act and everything else. Well, take that same thinking and apply it to streaming. You don't have to be, as you pointed out, like the old days, louder than the other guy because you don't have a point of reference. The only people that had a point of reference are those in a car on an AM or FM radio. After that, there is no point of reference.
Yeah.
So, being the loudest thing on the dial doesn't matter anymore. But what does matter is trying to stay above the fray.
I hope the car manufacturers are doing this right. I haven't experienced any of the really smart, entertainment-rich dashboards yet that are coming out. I need to get myself to an auto dealer and try some of that out. But at some point, and Mike, I wanted to hear your thoughts on this. When we have the connected dash, we're going to have AM, FM, and everything else on the internet all on the same dashboard. You're going to have Pandora. You might have Sirius XM. You're going to have all manner of different streaming services. And you know what? Those big guys are, for the most part, as far as I know, they're paying attention to their levels. I listen to Pandora Christmas music here at the house, and the levels are consistently good. Sometimes the spots are a bit wrong, but the music's all fine. And on my dash, if I'm going to go from Pandora to the GFQ network, or, to my radio stations in Mississippi streaming, the level's got to be a little bit consistent there with the other services, don't you think?
Absolutely, and that's why I actually disagree a little bit with what you and Chris are saying, that the consistency of levels, i.e. in terms of audio processing, are not as critical in podcasting and internet broadcasting yet. And to an extent, that's true. But you know what? It's getting there. It's kind of, we're in the CBS Automax Volumax days of broadcasting, where you didn't have to have a lot. You just had to sort of maintain a consistent level of modulation. Then we found out processing could make the sound much more appealing. And I believe that this podcasting industry, to use the term generically, is transitioning that way at a much faster pace. Now, you mentioned the Smart Dash. I hear a lot of people who say, okay, radio is dead, podcasting is going to kill it, and then Howard Stern, of course, argues with that. But I don't think radio's dead yet by any stretch of anyone's imagination. We all know what the problems are in the industry. That's another show. But what I would say, my prediction is that when we get to the point in time, whether it's a Smart Dash or whether it's now with a smartphone or whatever, when we get to the point in time that accessing This Week in Radio Tech on GFQ is a one-button, push-button affair, it's a game changer, because the theory that I have is, you guys would be interesting to hear what you think about it, but what I read is that the FCC is one of these days going to auction off the FM band, whether they like it or not, and that all radio, all audio, all TV is eventually going to be IP-based. So I do believe there's going to be a transition to IP. That's the future as far as I am concerned, for what I know. But we're not there yet. Radio's not dead. It's not going to be dead for a long, long time. But I do think that processing is critical. The one-button Smart Dash is going to be a game changer.
And you know what? I think we should probably clarify, because Chris and I come from, and I'm not sure your entire background, Mike, but we come from a world where to get that last bit of loudness on the FM dial, you got to do some unbelievable clipping that, thank goodness, the guys at Omnia and Orban and others have figured out ways to hide the clipping distortion. But that only works for AM and FM. It doesn't work for bit rate reduced audio encoders. So we can't do that with them. We can't run square waves into them. They lose all their efficiency and it really sounds bad. So when I'm talking about, we don't have to be loud like AM or FM. I'm really talking about that last that we've put a lot of science into figuring out how to eliminate. We still do need to be. I mean, we offer Omnia and the Zipstream brands and others offer multiband processing that can certainly be used to great effect. And I'm just saying that you don't have to have that last dB of crazy loudness that we so often look for in the FM band and even in AM. But we, processing is important to keep it good from cut to cut and to make it sound good. You know, what's fun to listen to is sometimes I get messages from some friends over in Europe, especially in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, they are crazy for audio processing. They just love it. And they have some streams where they're taking some of products from Omnia and some others as well and just really adjust them to where you listen to their streams and they sound amazingly good and they are incredibly loud. Whoa, you guys have really gone overboard here. You ever heard any of those, Mike or Chris?
Oh yeah, but again, it's another good point, because my background is AM radio. When you're trying to get decent sound out of nothing, right? You got nothing to work with sound wise, and if it hadn't been for Mike DeRose, Discriminate Audio Processor, I would probably not have had it sounding nearly as good as it sounded. But having said that, a couple of thoughts on processing as far as an internet stream is concerned. Chris, I don't know whether you've run into this in the streams you've set up, but while processing is a good idea, you have to be very careful not to process it like you do AM or FM, because you can hear it better and you get to hear the processing, which is what you don't want to hear. But there's also one other side effect that you have to be careful about. A home podcaster, for the most part, if we're talking at that level of podcasting, is actually in a home studio that probably has no acoustic treatment. It probably has less than perfect acoustics. If you put a lot of processing on that signal, you're going to hear the echoes in the room. And I have personally experienced that in trying to set up processing on several streams. And so that's a big gotcha.
Oh yeah, no, I absolutely. And I don't actually a friend of mine who works for a company that does processing, He always laughs because I go the opposite direction. He goes, yeah, you're the one that goes the negative. You're the one that does less processing to sound louder. I was like, well, in this environment, it actually works. And you're right. Home studios and podcasters at the home do not have the most ideal acoustics, and that's where it's important to understand that and work with it. No, absolutely. Yeah, I don't I don't take the approach of using AM or FM. And the DAP 310, great box. Used that on both AM and FM stations in my career. And boy, we have some great times with that.
Just remember the days of FET bias adjustments on those.
Hey, I did matrix processing with the DAP 310.
Did you?
It was wild. Wow. Oh, yeah. I did some experiments and played with some stuff. And straight wire audio, Bill Sachs used his products for that. And it was fun watching the meters move and how they function. And when people would come into the shop and say, well, you're processing. Are we allowed to look at it? I'm like, yeah, come on in. I don't care. You're not going to set the way I did. And they look at the meters like, there's something wrong with your stuff. I said, you know, I think you're right. So once in a while, I used to pop out the mid-range card or the high-frequency card on the L-R processing. And they look at me like, is that on the air? I said, yeah, but you know what? I think we're mono now. Well, let me put this back. And they look at me like, what the devil just happened? But they used to say they loved the stick. It was a new music format, so we had a lot of dynamics, a lot of kick, a lot of highs, mid. I mean, it's everything. Yeah. And they just loved the way it sounded. But, you know, matrix processing comes with its certain pros and cons, just like regular processing does. So as much fun as it could be very dangerous. Moving this forward to the internet, the streaming or processing, what's great is I don't have to worry about preemphasis, whether it be NRC, AM, or FM. I don't have to worry about clipping. I don't need the clipping. All I need is just consistent audio getting into the box so that I can get something, you know, relatively, I'll just say fat sounding, but not necessarily big fat, and just something pleasing. I'm all about fatigueless listening, whether it be a pop format or not. I've done some pop formats where we were screaming, but it was not fatiguing. So I that's what I'm about, because I think the end user needs to get the right thing, but you want to get the message across, you know, as far as the content you're creating.
This you've mentioned it a couple times now, and this would make an interesting show subject. It's a deep dive off in the weeds, but this whole concept of matrix processing instead of discrete left-right processing is really interesting, and what benefits you get from that and what you have to look out for when you're doing it. And I'm not claiming to be an expert on that. I've played with it a little bit, and obviously you've played with it on the air, and it's pretty interesting. It's worth some time talking about. Not on this podcast, don't have time for it. In fact, we're going to have to take our last break. And when we come back on it, we've got Chris Tobin here from New York, from the New York City area. And Mike Phillips is with us. Mike, I wonder if you could, in the time that I'm taking to do this last break, if you could come up with a tip for our listeners, keeping in with our theme as well. And then in our last little segment here, Chris and I have something to discuss that is frightening, and I don't want to embarrass anybody, so we're not going to show any IP addresses, but it's frightening. So we'll have that coming up. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavo, L-A-W-O. You might know Lavo as this company that makes great big audio consoles. Well, they also make a line of consoles for radio broadcasters. They're smaller. It's called the Crystal line of consoles. And one of those consoles, a little subgroup, is called the Crystal Clear from Lavo. And this is it right here. It is a console that has a touchscreen interface. And, you know, this is something that's pretty cool, I think. It may not be your cup of tea, but it may be. And if it is, well, you ought to take a look at Lavo, at L-A-W-O, Lavo.com. It's a German company. And they have offices in lots of countries, including in the U.S. And the idea behind the Crystal Clear console is that it uses the same input, output, and mixing engine as their Crystal line of consoles. So it's got a one-rack unit box that has all your audio inputs, microphones, mic pres built in, analog inputs, AES digital inputs, and as well as it's got analog outputs and AES digital outputs. It also has a network connection that will let you bring in other sources on the network, audio over IP, that are Ravenna standard or AES 67. The new worldwide standard for AOIP that, as far as I know, all the AOIP companies are building gear that includes that standard. So you can hook things together that have AES 67. Also, a couple of power supplies are built in. The whole DSP mixing engine is built in. And so that's the part that does the heavy lifting, if you will. Then on the network, you hook up this computer. And it's a beautiful multi-touch touchscreen that's got the computer built into the back of it, and you can pick this up and move it around if you want to. If you need to bring it over, you know, hey, I'm gonna do my show from my office today. No problem. You know, put the thing in your office, plug it into the network, and let it boot up, and there you go. You've got this full screen application that is the audio console. It's your It's your window into it. And so it does up to 10 touches at once, and that's how many fingers you have. So, you know, conveniently that works out. It's got 8 faders built into it, up to 24 inputs on the console, but 8 at a time on 8 faders. And then they can be anything. They can be mics or line level inputs and outputs. They can be codecs or hybrids or computer players, you know, an automation system, whatever like that, CD players. You get the capability of remote starts because you've got GPIO built into the rack unit box, so you can turn things on and off and start CD players or automation boxes or whatever. And it's all contextual too, because it's a software audio console. Whatever an input needs to be adjusted, that's what's available to you. So you don't have to, the point is you don't have to jump through a bunch of menus. When you touch an options button on the screen, you get options for that device. Of course, the console has, you know, so many standard things you've come to expect. A couple of different program buses are built in, plus a record bus. The clock on the thing keeps beautiful, perfect time because you can synchronize it to network time protocol, NTP. Automatic mix minus. We were talking about mix minus in our show and how that can be challenging to set up on a $350 Behringer console or a Mackie console. You're using aux buses to do that. Well, on the Lavo console, it's automatic. You assign an output to go to whatever the input was, you know, to the hybrid or the codec. And when you bring that fader up, you know, you get everything going back to that device except itself. So you're never feeding anybody back to themselves. It's really an amazing concept, and the whole idea of the touchscreen is very cool. Hey, if you mess something up, no problem. Just reset the scene, reset the preset for the show that you need to do. If you're interested, check this out at lavo.com. And on the product page for the Crystal Clear, you see right there on the right-hand side, there's a video you can click on. Mike Dosh, the director of virtual radio products for Lavo, he explains how the console works. Check it out if you would. And thanks a lot to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Mike Phillips, can
yes.
you provide us with a tip, please?
Absolutely, and it's going to sound so simple that it you may not think it's important, but I actually made this recommendation on Facebook, and that is don't go out and buy a piece of equipment just because someone else does. Do your homework. Buy what you need. For example, don't just buy a Blue Yeti because everyone else is using one. And if when you decide which mixer or console you're going to buy, make sure you buy one that's big enough. There chances are that the one you need is probably twice as big as the one you think you need. And I will tell you that it's a heck of a lot easier to have 4 channels unused than it is to need one more. So the bottom line, know what you're doing, buy what you need. You're going to have to spend some money. If you're not going to spend the money, then you're just playing with it, and there's only so much you can do. But know what you're doing, read the manual, and use your equipment wisely.
Great advice. Great advice. And you know what? Reading the manual, boy, these little consoles, as you mentioned, have so many knobs, especially the EQ and the aux sends. And how would you use those? You know, and you could read about how to use them and hopefully have somebody who knows what they're doing show you how to use them, or just experiment, figure out what you need to do. But
if I may,
a lot of knobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I may, Kirk, one of the things I meant to mention a while ago on these little cheap consoles, one of the mm-hmm. hardest issues I have teaching people is how to do gain staging. They don't know how to set their master controls. They don't know how to set their trim controls. They don't know where to set the landing positions on their faders. And that is a real problem.
So they may be distorting one place, even though they're turning it down somewhere else, and they still have the distortion. They have a quiet signal that's still distorted.
Happens and all the time.
There's a fix for that, and that is to get the gain right at every stage along the way.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
And also, if I can just jump in one more time, and you'll like this
absolutely.
One. The number one question I get is, how do I put a call on the air? How do I put a call? How do I broadcast a telephone call? And there are a lot of ways to do it, but I'm not stroking you, but I'll tell you, we bought an HX2, and I tell people, if you want to do it right, that's the right way. If you can't spend the money, then we'll talk about other ways, but that's the right way to do it for a small broadcaster. That HX2 telephone hybrid is a great little box, and there's some tweaks you can do to it to actually crank up the performance even beyond what it does when it comes out of the box, and so I'm a big fan.
Cool. I appreciate that, and that's very true. The Telos hybrids are amazing. That's the way to put a phone call on the air or on your podcast. Mike, thanks for being with us. Hang on, because I want to, with Chris, we're going to take a look at something that is a little bit shocking. You know, I know the world of IT and security can be confusing. We've heard news stories in the past couple of years about people hacking into EAS equipment, emergency alert system, EAS equipment, and putting nefarious messages on the air, bogus messages. So far, nobody's been hurt because of it, but, you know, it's certainly possible. Well, I got a message the other day from a friend who said, "You won't believe what I just found on the internet." And Suncast, have you got that shot available for us? There's a live look, live right now, at a radio station's EAS box. If you Google, you can find this box. Fortunately, they've changed the password. So, but that is a radio station's live EAS box right there. And if you knew the password, you could get right into it. And if you had the time to hack into it, you probably could. Don't do this, folks. Chris, my theory was the station put in the EAS box, wanted remote access, didn't really know how to go about doing that in a safe way. So they probably just told their router, hey, make the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, the easy universal access method, just point it at this EAS box, and we'll be able to get to it from our house, you know, or wherever we need to. And there it is, hanging out on the internet. The emperor has no clothes for all to see. What do you think? Could I be right?
I'm going to say yes. Only because I have run into that a couple of times, a couple of places with the same very limited IT support. People thought, yeah, Oh, that makes sense. Let's do it. Not realizing the ramifications. But what worries me is if you find this type of device on the internet from a broadcaster, and if they do say, if somebody says, well, that's our way of doing remoting. We do this, this, and this. I have to say, well, you know what? You need to step back, pick up a book on how to remote access the office environment and learn about VPNs or terminal services, remote desktop services, what else are there? Other methods that you could use to get to that same box remotely from any computer in the world safely. And I can say that because I've done it on many occasions with a couple of setups I have, you know, using terminal server and off you go and you're good. But yeah, it's just, you got to be careful. I mean, even if you say, you know, well, I got a password that's 37 characters with entropy that's enough to, you know, it would take you 5 billion years to figure it out. What you don't know is if there are any other security vectors that that box has that the manufacturer hasn't told anybody, or I guess we'll call them zero-day effects, zero-day hacks. And that's what worries me. You know, the product, great product, does what it's supposed to, but we don't know, it's not public knowledge, what methods and what testing they did to make sure that that port, that access, whether it's, you know, port 80 and whatnot, has been properly vetted.
Yeah. And you know, at least at a minimum, what you don't want to do, and by the way, I can speak to this because I did something really stupid back in the early days of the internet. In American Samoa, they would just give their customers 5 IP addresses that were all public. And you're supposed to assign your computer, you know, up to 5 computers, a public IP address. And so we had our automation system sitting on the public internet. This was back, this may have been before Windows XP. This may have been Windows, 2000 or 90. It may have been Windows 95. Yeah, you know what? It was Windows 95. Windows 95, which had no firewall, all these sockets open, and sitting on a public internet address out there for anybody to hack into. And after about a year and a half, somebody did and wiped out our C drive just because they could. And so we were off the air for a couple of days while we had a local computer shop rebuild the C drive. Luckily, all the commercials and music were on the D drive, and they didn't bother with that one. But they had and then we realized, oh, yes, well, it's wide open. So why don't we get a router that has a firewall? I've heard of these things now. But at the time I plugged the stuff in, I hadn't even heard of a router. So this was back in the – actually in the mid late 90s. So, okay, please excuse me. But I learned my lesson back then, and there are more lessons to be learned. There's, you know, you don't want to do what this radio station did and put your EAS box right out there on the public internet for everybody to see. And I wouldn't have shown that except you can Google just a few little keywords and find that exact box. It's not hiding. It's, you know, Google has made it known where that box is. So, yeah, be careful out there, and don't do what that station does. I sent them a very nice letter, by the way, just telling them the problem and letting them know that I'd be happy to help them, you know, make that more secure, or tell their engineer, you know, what they need to do. So, scary.
So password one is no longer password?
What's that? Password one is not the password?
Password one is no longer the password for that box?
Yeah. Apparently, neither is monkey or 1234567. I didn't try it. I've taken somebody else telling me that the default password from the company that makes that box is no longer the password. So that's all I know.
That's great.
So, well, hey, so yeah, don't do that's our tip for me and Chris. Don't do that. Find out how to do it better. Hey, thanks for watching This Week in Radio Tech. Our guest has been Mike Phillips. Thank you for joining us, Mike, with your great I'm still going to – if I ever come across $1,000, I'm going to get one of those microphones. The Sennheiser.
I might just send you one.
Well, no, you don't have to do that.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind buying a used one somewhere, but I'd like to try that thing out. So, Mike, I hope you'll join us again sometime with some more information for basic audio stuff.
Anytime. It's a thrill, Kirk.
All right. Chris Tobin, who is available at support@ipcodex.com, and he keeps half of New York City on the air. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks. A little less than half.
Okay, a little less than half. Yeah, no disrespect to all the other fine engineers in New York City, but Chris is one of the finest. And I'm Kirk Harnack, and we got some good things coming up on the show, including in a few weeks. By the way, next 2 weeks, probably no new show. That is Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. Yeah, we're going to run reruns. We're taking some sleepy time off. But coming up in January, we've got Robbie Green. He's going to be on the show telling us about this incredible world of network aggregation in the cell phone carrier industry, where you can get great bandwidth and you can do remotes from lots of places that you didn't think you could. And then another guest coming up is Dick DiBartolo, the maddest writer at Mad Magazine, and he does a show called The Giz Whiz, and he's going to come on with some great audio gizmos to show us coming up in January. We're going to really enjoy having Dick DiBartolo on the show. So we'll see you guys next week with a rerun on This Week in Radio Tech. Take care. Bye-bye.